The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/NYT. netsuite.com/NYT.
Hey everyone, it's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
I know you see this nation as a place that is opposed to commit to freedom, the ingredients of which are equality, opportunity, and fair play. I know you have those aspirations for this country, and there isn't anybody else in the race who has worked on those issues for his entire career in private and public sector.
Hi, I'm Katie Kingsbury from the New York Times editorial board, and welcome to The Choice, a new podcast that brings you behind closed doors and into the exclusive deliberations process around the New York Times pick for the 2020 presidential candidate. In each episode, you'll hear Democratic presidential candidates make their pitch as they interview for the biggest job of their career. Every election year, the board chooses a candidate after closed-door, off-the-record interviews and a lot of internal debate. But the stakes are so high in 2020, and we think voters deserve to hear how we decided on our pick as the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. So we're giving you access to these conversations and the debates that followed so you can make the choice for yourself. To learn more about how the board works and who's on it, go back and listen to episode one of this series. We've trimmed each of these interviews down, but if you'd like to read the full transcript, you can find them on nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S.
Hi, everyone. I'm Deval Patrick. I used to be governor of Massachusetts, but that's not where I started.
The next visitor to our boardroom was the third and final candidate from New England, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Governor Patrick is a Harvard-educated lawyer who grew up on the south side of Chicago. He worked for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and later served as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights under Bill Clinton. In 2006, Mr. Patrick became the first African-American governor in Massachusetts history, succeeding Mitt Romney. He served two terms as governor before returning to the private sector, working at the private equity firm Bain Capital. That's right, Mitt Romney's Bain Capital. There, he dedicated his work to impact investing, investing in companies with the potential to lift up disadvantaged communities. Though he flirted with running in 2016, it wasn't until this past November that he officially announced his candidacy for president.
But I am not running to be president of the Democrats. I'm running to be president of the United States.
His pitch to the American people is a moderate one, supporting a public option for health insurance and distancing himself from a wealth tax. But despite being in Barack Obama's inner circle of friends and powerful Democrats, Mr. Patrick has struggled to break 1% in the polls after his late entry into the race. We wanted to ask what made him want to jump in this already crowded field.
You know, I was looking more at the country than at the field. I have felt for some while deep gratitude for my own American journey. Have had the range of life and leadership experiences that I have had, and I have been concerned about the accessibility of that dream for fewer and fewer people in more and more places. And I think it was true, you know, when I first left the South Side of Chicago at 14 in 1970, and I think it is a deeper concern and ought to be for all of us, because I think the American dream is defining and worth fighting for. And that's the reason that I looked hard at getting in a little bit more than a year ago. And some of you may know this, but we were 2 or 3 weeks from an announcement. We had a whole rollout plan and everything. And my wife was diagnosed with uterine cancer. And so that's the sort of thing that sort of just brings your feet back to earth. We paid attention to her and to that. I was just saying outside that when we celebrated 35 years of marriage in May, she's cancer-free. She's doing great. She's fired up. I continued to watch the field as it was evolving. And I have a lot of friends in the field. And I've been talking to them through their campaigns. But you know, it is still true, and I say it as humbly as a candidate can, there isn't anyone with the range of life and leadership experiences that I have had in the field, with the problem-solving experiences I have had in government, in the private sector, here in the United States and overseas. And I think I've learned from that to get change that lasts, you have to be willing to bring other people in. And not to make the agenda any less ambitious, but to get solutions that are the success points and bragging points for a whole lot of people, you have to make space for people, including folks who may not agree with you. So I think that because I think this is a moment where we can't miss beyond replacing the incumbent president, the willingness of people to invest in their own aspirations in our government, I think is right on the edge.
When you get in this late, there are logistical challenges. You may not be on the Michigan primary ballot. You're not going to be in the debates. So what is your path?
I think voters are just starting to pay attention. My reception in Iowa was very warm, as it has been in each of the early states. We're going to compete and compete hard, and we're going to deal with the skepticism that I have faced in every campaign, every other stage of my life. There's nothing I've done where somebody said, you can't do that. That's not for you. It's not your turn. It's not your time. I'm used to that. But I think what I'm asking of voters, and maybe I'll respectfully ask it of you, you know, take a chance on your own aspirations. I read this paper every single day, every day. I know what you care about. I know you see this nation as a place that is supposed to commit to freedom, the ingredients of which are equality, opportunity, and fair play. I know you have those aspirations for this country, and there isn't anybody else in the race who has worked on those issues for his entire career in private and public sector.
While we didn't want to ask the questions we'd already heard in the debates, we actually hadn't heard Governor Patrick's take on quite a few of the biggest topics in the Democratic primary. Like, does he support Medicare for All?
Ha. Medicare for All is a slogan we've been using for a whole bunch of different things. What I support is a public option. Whether that public option is Medicare or not, I'm totally open to that. But the point is to get health care to everybody that is affordable. I don't support eliminating the private insurance industry. And it's not because I have any particular fondness for the private insurance industry. It's just I think you get a creative tension in having private insurance, having to figure out how to compete with a lower cost alternative that is publicly paid for. And you get some innovation on the Medicare side, where CMS is going to have to think about how to make its offerings, its quality, comparable to and broad as broad as the private insurance industry. And that's a good thing. And I think we as citizens, I think, are hungry for innovation in public policy in the same way we see it in the private sector. But if you want successful innovation, the environment has to tolerate failure. But politics punishes failure. So we get less innovation than we'd like. So in Massachusetts, we had a broad coalition of policymakers, providers, patient advocates, interfaith leaders, all kinds of folks who came together to invent healthcare reform and then stuck together because we kept learning things. Governor Romney signed the bill. It took effect the day I took office. We should call it Patrick Care, by the way, not Romney Care. And we got to 98.5% insured in short order. But I signed, I don't know, 3, 4, maybe 5 major healthcare reform bills after the first one. Why? Because we kept learning things. And we kept trying to improve on the strength of what we learned. And that's what it's going to have to be like at the federal level.
As governor, you were tasked with presiding over the earliest years of Romney Care, and you were really forced to grapple with the balance between expanding access to health care and containing costs. And I'm just curious, looking back, what the key lessons you think you learned from that are, and what which of those lessons you would take, to the White House.
Unlike the ACA, our health care reform was only about access and not about cost. It had no cost containment mechanisms. The medical home idea, for example, that's entirely from the ACA. Fabulous idea. But we didn't have that. One of the things I found about the conversation around cost, remember I was talking about that coalition that came together and stuck together, is that here we have the economy collapsing and premiums going up year after year, well ahead of inflation. And the great power of a governor and a president, for that matter, I think is the convening power. Everyone will come to the table. Everyone came to the table, and I would say, what is going on? We need a solution to that. The answer always started with, it's complicated. And then hospitals would point to the doctors, and the doctors would point to the specialists or to the insurers and so on, and no one took any responsibility for any of it. I think that's one of the reasons, by the way, why the appeal of a Medicare solution is so great. It's so simple and familiar seeming. And at one point, I lost my... I had a sort of a public hissy fit, and we froze the state's willingness to pay any more for services that under the that were provided on our own exchange. We ultimately got to a piece of legislation and some regulations under it that required a collaborative arrival at what increases could be, should be, still too high in my view, but we got to something. One of the reasons why a low-cost, publicly paid public option is attractive to me. It goes back to something I was saying earlier. Private, not just insurance, but the private healthcare environment will figure out a way to compete for that part of the market.
Allow me one follow-up on that, which is Massachusetts is home to many of the nation's most prestigious hospitals, yet they're not often part of the conversation around the questions of healthcare costs and what are driving them. We often hear about prescription drugs and insurance and those. Can you talk a little bit about what changes you think hospitals need to make?
So community hospitals and community care have to be a big part of the solution and be a lot more convenient, all apart from the
You know what the problem is there, though, right? Like, if prestige. You have Mass General an hour away, why would you go to the local hospital?
Well, so one answer to that has been transparency. I'm just not sure that people, they buy a new hip in the same way they buy soap. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we make our healthcare decisions that way. I'm all for transparency. You can go on the website in Massachusetts and see what a new hip costs at Milton Hospital versus MGH. That's a part of it.
Would you push for a wealth tax?
Well, my answer is that's not the answer from my perspective, mostly because I don't think wealth is the issue. It's greed. I do think we need massive simplification of the individual or the personal income tax system. We ought to treat all income as income. We ought to just make it a lot simpler. On the corporate side, even the business communities didn't want the rates to go that low. So I think those rates probably need to go up as much as 4 or 5 points. But the work isn't finished unless you eliminate the loopholes, because most of those were in place for, around arguments that the rate beforehand was too high. So that work is unfinished. What is attractive to me about the frame of a wealth tax is to think about it as a one-time assessment against things like, bringing the deficit down, eliminating student debt. As a practical matter, on an ongoing basis, I'm not quite sure it works. But you have to acknowledge the frustration and resentment that a lot of people feel about where we are and how we got here. And that's to my point about greed. When I was growing up on the South Side of Chicago, on welfare, nobody gave us the message we were to resent rich people. It was about, here's what the stuff you have to do to get to be that. And the things you had to do and the rules you had to abide by to get to be that have all been compromised in my time. And I think there's a whole lot we can do around that. And that's what our opportunity agenda is about. You'll hear more about that. It's about investing in education, in innovation, which is a strategy, a movement, a representation of how the knowledge-based economy is becoming and how we can own it as a nation, and infrastructure, which is the unglamorous work that government does that enables all the rest.
How do you feel about free college tuition?
I think that public colleges and universities should be much, much more affordable. And by the way, I think that from my experience in Massachusetts, that has to do with the public coming out of public college and university. We tried to get to a 50-50 contribution in exchange for freezes. We didn't get much further than that, and I think it's slipped back since. But one of the things I'm interested in is this notion of national service, sort of work that General McChrystal has been working on and has proposed, and that I've co-chaired with him for a whole lot of other reasons. But alongside that, I love the idea of having a year or two of tuition relief in exchange for your time contributing to the common good.
After Mr. Patrick left the Clinton administration, he went to the private sector, working as general counsel for big corporations like Texaco and Coca-Cola. From 2004 to 2006, he was a board member of the parent company of AmeriQuest, the largest lender of subprime mortgages, which played a big role in the Great Recession. We wanted to know more about his tenure there.
Most Americans, their biggest investment is their home. That's how they create an ownership stake. That's how they grow wealth. Back in 2005, you described AmeriQuest as a good company.
Mm-hmm.
That's a company that destroyed the wealth of a lot of American homeowners. What did you mean, and do you regret it?
Look, I think the reason I went on that board is because they needed some help in trying to figure out how to make their products available to people who wanted homes who couldn't get a mortgage in the regular market. And we did, I think, a lot of good work in that respect. Not all of those loans were bad loans. I think, in retrospect, the bundling of those loans and securitizing them in a volatile market was a terrible idea and contributed to a lot of the hardship. But it's also true, a lot of folks who wouldn't have been able to get access to mortgages got them and are still in their homes. So, yes, I think I wouldn't do it again, and I don't think AmeriQuest would do that again in the same way. But I think the intentions were right, and I think that the problem remains, and we do need solutions to get at that the market alone is not going to deliver.
We wanted to hear more about Governor Patrick's position on solutions to the climate crisis. So we asked him about the Green New Deal, the legislative package calling for the government to wean the United States off fossil fuels and curb greenhouse gas emissions.
Do you support the Green New Deal?
I can tell you in Massachusetts, we joined the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. We use those, which is a, you probably know, regional cap and trade system. We use those proceeds to invest in energy efficiency. We're number one in energy efficiency. We closed the last two coal power plants. We created a statewide and then with regional variations, resilience and recovery plan, invested behind that. And we stimulated a clean tech sector with an emphasis on solar alongside wind and efficiency, which was one of the sectors whose jobs helped lift us out of recession.
Would you push for reparations?
Look, reparations don't mean a thing without reconciliation, in my view. And that's another one, by the way, where people mean a lot of different things by the use of a single term. We have a lot of unfinished business in this country. And I don't think it's going to get resolved by just writing a check. And when I say just, I don't mean to diminish the continuing economic hardships that have their roots in slavery and a lot of other bad decisions that we've made over time. But I think we need to understand that history. We need to confront that history so that it isn't just about an economic shift. It's really about justice. When the government changed in South Africa, of course, they had the benefit of having a saint for a president, but nobody was more entitled to their rage than Black South Africans. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was about making a history of fact about what happened, having folks who were the perpetrators on the record talking about that and engaging and acknowledging that, I think was enormously important. And we don't and have not done that in this country. I heard Governor Haley say just the other day that, you know, she referred to how Dylann Roof had hijacked the Confederate flag, which was otherwise a symbol of service and sacrifice. No. No, it's not. It's a symbol of division and hate and intimidation, and it has been flown that way in many, many places to make people like me afraid.
What should government's role in a truth and reconciliation process be?
I think some of it is leadership. Put the policies to one side. You may be getting at the policies. I'm not saying ignore the policies, but we have to start with the what Lonnie Guinier used to talk about as the conversation. And I think convenings around that where people can say the stuff that and hear the stuff that we need to understand about our history, what it really is, you know, what happened at the end of Reconstruction for Reconstruction to end, what the deal was, and then the concerted effort to retell the South's story. And do that in a way that doesn't make the folks who...
They lost the war, but they won the peace. Our current president ran for office on the most racist campaign in my lifetime, with the exception of George Wallace. Mm.
And wakes up every day trying to figure out how to divide us further.
And he did that. But candidates in this period appear to me to be... They want to somehow elide that and walk by that and talk about social division. 43% of the population... will accept almost anything Trump does. What his campaign showed was racism had a broad constituency in the United States. Mm. So how do you walk by that? How do you campaign without addressing that directly?
As a friend of mine puts it, I am convinced, as he is, that all the racists voted for Trump. I am not convinced that all the people who voted for Trump are racist.
No one who does this for a living, as I do, thinks that either. People either embrace that or it did not matter to them. A lot of people didn't hear it. A lot of people embraced it.
Yep.
That rhetoric has a broad constituency.
Yep.
What do you do about that?
Look, I started out as a civil rights lawyer for the Legal Defense Fund.
I
was the head of the Civil Rights Division. I mean, these issues are important to me personally. I live this life.
Well, how do you talk about that?
How do you get in the campaign? That way. Mm-hmm. Just that way. I remember being here in New York 6 months ago, in jeans and a blazer and a casual shirt and a cap in a shop walking distance from here. And folks who walked in and got waited on by the staff and walked right past me. And I could never get any attention, even when I kept saying, excuse me, don't tell me racism is over. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. And I also understand that part of our healing, and it's what I was trying to say earlier, is about, you know, convening around those issues. There are a whole lot of people who feel that the conversation is over because you are right and righteous. To get solutions, frankly, to make it possible for people to have the conversation, you got to make it possible for them to say their piece too. You know, I've lived my whole life straddling these two worlds, or a lot of it. I remember when I went to, when I left the South Side of Chicago when I was 14, I'd been in, you know, big, broken, overcrowded public schools till then. Everybody in the classroom looked just like me and was just like me. Everything was broken. I went off to Milton Academy and everybody wasn't. And you're straddling these two worlds as if the price of admission to the one is rejecting the other. And I had to decide who I was and be that all the time. Because that was the only way for me to be able to live and move in more than one world. I think in some ways, that has been America's struggle all along. It's the struggle of candidates. It's not something I'm unfamiliar with. It's not something I have hidden from.
More from our interview after a quick break.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/NYT. netsuite.com/NYT.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice. In Mr. Patrick's 2 terms as governor, he implemented a statewide health insurance reform program, pushed through a $13 billion transportation infrastructure bill and focused on education policies to close the achievement gap. He left office with a pretty good approval rating, though not without its scandals.
Four-week-old Aliana Levine of Grafton is one of the children who was under DCF supervision when she died. The agency admitted this weekend it misplaced a faxed 51...
Most tragically were the deaths of several very young children under the watch of the Department of Children and Families, which was being run by a civil servant named Olga Roche.
Commissioner Roche has the expertise to lead this agency. But it's clear from the events of this weekend that she can no longer command the trust of the public or the confidence of her...
We wanted to ask Governor Patrick about his handling of that.
I want to turn to your record, if that's okay. As governor, you chose to cut the Department of Children and Families basically to the bone during the downturn. That really launched DCF into a tailspin, and we saw several horrific cases of children who were under DCF's watch, but who were killed or neglected in really terrible ways. Do you have any regrets about that decision? Would you have done it differently in any way, especially around, for instance, the firing of Olga Roche?
Well, listen, I think, first of all, it's not exactly so that we cut it to the bone. We cut everything.
You chose to cut it over some programs that others would argue were less vital than DCF.
Yeah, that's what others whose line item that isn't would argue, and that's how it is. It was a terrible circumstance trying to deal with the bottom falling out of the budget, and those outcomes were terrible. Does anyone know what you're talking about? Should I say a little bit more about the case? Because there was one particularly horrific case where a child was supposed, as a part of the plan, was supposed to be checked on regularly. And the social worker who was responsible for that lied about it, said that she was checking when she wasn't, and told her supervisor that she was lying about it, and the supervisor lied about it to the supervisor's supervisor. And then the child was lost. And when we learned that, we fired the social worker and the supervisor, and we reprimanded the supervisor's supervisor. And yet, people wanted the head of the agency's head on a pike.
I mean, that was one particularly terrible situation.
That was the worst.
It was. I would agree with you.
Yeah.
But there were several cases that happened under Olga Roche's watch that were unbelievable from the outside. And I'm sympathetic to the idea that it's almost impossible in a situation that DCF finds itself in to protect every child.
Yeah.
I take that point.
Yeah. They're horrible.
But I guess I'm just curious. I'm kind of looking for a little self-reflection in terms of, was there anything that your administration could have done differently that would have perhaps prevented one of those cases?
It's impossible to know. You know, I'm still tormented by that, because as you acknowledged in your question, these are the hardest possible cases and the hardest possible situations on a good day. I think some of the things we learned in the course of the review that the new head helped us do was that there are tools they could have had that might have helped. And that's, I can only use the conditional words because you just don't know. You know, being able to do more remotely on iPads. I mean, it seems sort of quaint to say it now, but the reporting requirements that were all by hand and all had to be done back on the computer, back in the office, when the action was out on the street, is something we might have anticipated and supplied, but didn't. And we learned about that as we went forward. So, yeah, I'm sorry about it. I'm totally sorry about it, and have been from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, you said earlier you tried to build bridges. You certainly did some of that in Massachusetts, but actually some of the biggest challenges you had came from the all-Democrat legislature.
Please.
And I'm kind of curious how that kind of informs how you would handle Mitch McConnell's Senate, for instance.
I was an unwelcome entrant when I started the campaign. And, you know, for 16 years before, the legislative leadership had Republican governors. And as one of them described it to me, when the governor would submit his or her budget, they'd take the budget and say, thank you very much, and toss it into the fireplace. And we started in. It was bumpy. But I will say the legislature gave me 95% of what I asked for, rarely when I asked for it, rarely in the form I asked for it. And that was the lesson. We got the goal, which was not the bill, but what the bill was trying to do, right? But there were other ways of thinking about how to get there that had to be accommodated in order to get it done. And so I think what I learned was the importance of being real clear about the objectives and also a willingness to use sharp elbows, but without embarrassing people publicly. By the way, Leader McConnell plays a completely different game. And I do think that there is work that I would be eager to do as a candidate and as a nominee and as president alongside candidates for the Senate, because we do need a Senate that is willing to work with the White House.
In 1993, the husband of Governor Patrick's sister was twice convicted of spousal rape in California and served prison time there. His sister and brother-in-law then reconciled and moved to Massachusetts, and he apparently never registered as a sex offender there. In Mr. Patrick's first year as governor, the Sex Offender Registry Board decided that his brother-in-law did not have to register because he committed his crime in a different state. Several employees on the registry board subsequently overturned that decision. The governor could have just stayed out of the whole thing, but instead he decided to fire those employees. The scandal has dogged him ever since.
I actually have another question from when you were governor. I was wondering if you could please speak to how it is that your brother-in-law was able to avoid registering on the sex offender registry in Massachusetts, despite being convicted of rape.
Very painful story for our family. He was ruled by a hearing officer under the existing rules. They have since changed under the existing rules as not having to register. There was an attempt to undermine that, which I learned about later, not at the time. And there was no mechanism, by the way, for trying to undermine that, for, lawfully, anyhow. If what you're getting at is the dismissal of the leader.
I am.
Yes. The failure to update rules, the failure to some indication that there had been harassment of some of the staff and accumulation of things. And then learning about this attempt to interfere with a hearing officer against the law, that you can't, I can't tolerate.
Because this involved your sister, and again, as you just said, I'm sure this is a very painful situation for your entire family, but isn't that a reason why you should have recused yourself from this situation?
I stayed as far away from this as long as I could.
But you were directly involved in the dismissal of—
While all these other things were accumulating.
Uh-huh.
And the dismissal is the governor's decision. And I asked for her and others' resignation in the there. By the way, I think people sometimes get this a little backwards. She didn't actually do anything that hurt him. It was the interference in the hearing officer's decision, which she had no authority to do, and the rules are the rules.
Sure. I think the bigger question in the public's mind seems to be why you were directly involved there.
Because I'm the appointing individual. I had the appointing authority and the removal authority.
And there was no mechanism for anyone else to make the call there.
No. And it wasn't just that, as I said. She'd been reprimanded twice by our highest court, the agency had, for not updating these rules that were required to be updated. And believe me, the political thing would have been to stay away from it. I just washed my hands of the whole thing. And then, of course, somebody would come along and say, well, wait a second, she was trying to influence a hearing officer's a decision outside of her authority, and how come you look the other way? And my answer, I don't like my answer to be because it was the political thing to do.
To stay with criminal justice for a moment, your record with pardons and commutations in the state, didn't pardon or commute the sentences of that many people. How would you approach the job as president with you know, the clemency power being one of the most unfettered powers that a president has?
Yeah, the clemency power of a governor is not, in Massachusetts, is not unfettered. One of the things we looked at that I'm very intrigued by from the president's perspective is commuting the sentences of people who have been convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. It's hard to do that quite categorically, but I think there are groups.
Well, President Obama tried to do that.
I know.
Near the end of his term.
I know. I think he probably had to start sooner because of you have to do an individual assessment. I think it's just wise. But getting to that sooner, I think, is a very intriguing opportunity. That alongside changing the schedules around which offenses qualify for which kinds of sentencing and smoothing out and ending three strikes and you're out and sentencing reform. You know who's been leaders at the state level on this are Republican governors. They've been way out ahead of Democratic governors. And when we first proposed sentencing reform in Massachusetts, our Democratic leadership were incredibly uncomfortable because of, you know, I always say Democrats are the first ones to believe Republican talking points. And folks were really concerned about being viewed as so-called soft on crime.
For millions of Americans, church and religion are a central part of their lives. Can you talk to us a little bit about your own faith? Do you believe in God? Who are your main spiritual advisors?
I was raised in the church. I am a person of faith. My church, you know, it's interesting. Our church on the south side of Chicago was unusual as Black churches go. It was quiet. It was like other Black churches in terms of the transformational power of music in the church, and also old ladies in hats who, you know, who took the business of worship seriously. And I think what I took from that experience and still take from that experience is that faith is not, it's not just what you say you believe, it's how you live. It's the choices you make, the good you try to do. And I will say also, you know, I love Democrats. Democrats get on my last nerve. And I don't know why it is we are so uncomfortable with the language of faith when the work we are about and have been about as a party is very much what Christ asks of his disciples in the last story, in the last gospel, feed my sheep.
Given your faith, how do you reconcile the job of directing the largest, most powerful military in the world with the Christian obligation of loving your enemy?
Well, scripture also teaches, I can't remember which, where it appears, when they're building the wall of the second temple to do so with a shovel in one hand and a sword in the other. The world is a dangerous and difficult place. I think my faith tells me, and I think wisdom tells me not to be trigger happy. Try not to be the first one to fire that shot, but be ready. I think our power in the world is not so much our military or our economic power. I mean, great nations with great armies and great treasuries have come and gone with the winds of time. Our power is our values. It's the aspirations of the American experiment, which go back to those notions, those civic ideals of equality, opportunity, and fair play. And I think we are more powerful in the world when we have fealty to those values at home and more at risk when we don't. And I think that's part of our challenge today.
Now, let me ask you, continuing that thought perhaps, about Israel. President Trump has taken some fairly controversial unilateral steps, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital, accepting that settlements are legal, accepting Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Would you reverse those actions? Do you think they're reversible?
You know, the first time I went to Israel was as governor, and I remember I sat down with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Tel Aviv, and then I sat down with Abu Mazen in Jerusalem because the consulate sort of functioned as the embassy for the Palestinians. And realistically speaking, the capital of Israel has been Jerusalem for a long time. But I think the business of tolerating and, in fact, encouraging the settlements, as someone who believes in a two-state solution, seems to me to be completely counterproductive and to make harder what Israel says it wants, which is both a democratic and a Jewish state. And it's, you know, without a two-state solution, I'm not sure you get there. Yeah, I'm not sure you get there.
Would you reverse those actions that he's taken?
Reverse means what?
Declaring that they're illegal.
Well, I think they are illegal. But I think declaring is one thing. I think actually delivering a long-term solution is another. And I think that requires both partners who are willing, and that's been a problem, I think, on both sides, but also also more than declaring. We have leverage points, and I think we should use them, and we should use them respectfully. I think, by the way, the interrelationship between, first of all, Israel's an incredibly important democracy and partner of ours in the region and will always be if I'm president. I believe in Israel's right to exist. I believe also that Palestinians deserve the dignity of being human beings and being treated so. What I was going to say is the interrelationship between what is going on between Israelis and Palestinians and what is going on in the larger region between Shia and Sunni and the proxies of Iran and Saudi Arabia, I think it can be and probably ought to be a focus of a comprehensive approach by my administration.
Can I ask you about Afghanistan? Do you think the Trump administration is going about resolving that war in the appropriate way?
The Trump administration?
Yeah, they're negotiating with the Taliban.
Yeah.
It's been off and on, but he hasn't done the deal. I mean, this is somebody who wanted to end the war. He's had 3 years to do it. It still hasn't been done. So. Yeah,
and I read the series from the Post as well. I don't know what the answer is.
Do you find anything surprising in that series?
I went to Kabul with some other governors several years ago to visit National Guard's men and women who were there because there were so many National Guard supplementing regular military. I visited Iraq and Afghanistan. General Petraeus was still there at the time. He did not say directly, but you kind of get a feel from his team that there wasn't really a plan. There was a hope that the Taliban would take back, or that a government would take back responsibility for Afghanistan and manage going forward, but not really a plan. And I don't know enough. I don't have all of the intelligence and the diplomatic information, but there has got to be a way for us responsibly to end endless war and to be more rigorous about our objectives going in and our strategy for coming out, mindful that things change, but it doesn't seem like we had much more than a grudge for going into Afghanistan in the first place.
So you said that you were there and you sort of came away with the sense that there wasn't a plan. I mean, shouldn't you have said something at the time? This was exactly the lesson of these Washington Post papers that everybody knew and no one had the courage to come out and say it publicly.
Well, when you say come out and say it, you know, stand up and make a statement. What I did do before I went and after I came home was debrief with the State Department. I briefed before I went and I debriefed with State when I got back.
And if we had that declassified, would it show your concerns?
I think it would.
One last thing we're asking everyone. What are you likely to fail at as president?
I'm impatient. And, you know, these jobs require patience. I'm a pretty good listener. I acknowledge that, you know, I don't have to be the smartest one in the room and am often not. I want the smartest people in the room to help me make decisions. And I want them to feel free to disagree and push back. So I don't want people who just say yes in the room. I think those are the best teams I've been on, and those are the best outcomes. But I am very impatient because it turns out, you know, 4 years, 8 years, is just not long. It's just not long. And I'm proud of the fact that after 8 years, we were in Massachusetts first in student achievement and healthcare coverage and veteran services and energy efficiency and entrepreneurial activity and you know, the highest bond rating in our history, 25-year employment high. But I also know how much we didn't get done. I also know what we didn't get right in terms of some of the social services and in particular the loss of children. I also know I know how much of the infrastructure we did get right, but some we didn't get to. You just don't have as much time as you think. And so I try to cram a lot into a day and into the time I have, because I think you're supposed to do as much good as you can for as many people as you can in all the ways you can for as long as you can. And that's taxing on a lot of people, on your own team, on the legislature, on all y'all in the media, trying to keep up with it, and sometimes on the American people. But yeah, that's it.
Okay, we'll leave it there.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for the time.
So that was most of the editorial board's interview with former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. To read the full conversation, visit nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. If you want to hear the board's impression of Mr. Patrick's visit and a deep dive into foreign policy positions in the race, check out the Deliberations episode. It also comes out today. We'll be back in your feed tomorrow with the board's final interview with former Vice President Joe Biden. You won't want to miss it.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.